Welcome to today's presentation, the 2018 Legislative Update for Law Enforcement. This webinar is brought to you by the Utah Prosecution Council, the Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training. I'm Christopher Fielding of Post Media Services, and I will be moderating today's webinar. We are also pleased to have with us today Tyson Skeen, Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor with the Utah Prosecution Council, and Marlise Jones, Sexual Assault Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor, also with the Utah Prosecution Council. We'll now turn the time over to Tyson Skeen.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. We're happy to be here again this year doing our legislative update. As said, I'm Tyson Skeen, the Traffic Safety Resource Prosecutor with the Prosecution Council, and I'm here with Marlise Jones, and I'll let her introduce herself as well.
And as said twice already, Marlise Jones. I'm the Domestic Violence Sexual Assault Resource Prosecutor with the Prosecution Council. We're just going to start off by going through the bills and kind of dial them down to what you need to know. Specifically, we would encourage you to read any of these bills that have some interest to you. I'm starting off with House Bill 13. This is creating a public safety peer counseling support team. Your administration of your individual agencies are now able to create a peer support team. The benefit of this team is it also comes with a quasi-privilege for communications, meaning that as you talk to each other, what you share with each other may not be protected or confidential. However, if you share some information involving an incident that causes you concern or distress with someone of a designated team, you may have privilege. Now, there are some exceptions to that privilege, including if the peer support team member was a witness or party to the underlying event, they may not be able to keep your communication confidential. If the communication indicates child abuse or neglect, they may not be able to keep the communication confidential. If the support seeker poses a clear or immediate danger to themselves or others, the communication may not be kept confidential. The support seeker is reasonably believed to be mentally or emotionally unfit for duty, then that communication may also need to be disclosed. And if the support seeker communicates evidence that they've committed a crime, plans to, or intends to conceal a crime, that communication may not be kept confidential. So this falls under the Utah Rule of Evidence 507, which is a new rule providing that protection. So just be aware of that. And hopefully your agencies, as they create these teams, will be able to provide a higher level of support within the group itself.
And one thing I probably should have mentioned at the outset, and I apologize about that, is all of these bills went into effect in May of 2018. Otherwise, we will let you know the implementation date. But May 8, 2018 is when all these went into effect, unless otherwise noted. But the majority, vast majority of them are already in effect as we're making this recording. So House Bill 14, Substance Abuse Treatment Facility Patient Brokering. This is a bill that specifically targets the payment or solicitation of payment for referring people for substance use treatment. So it's not in an attempt to punish courts or insurance providers or any of these people who, as a course of business, make referrals to substance use treatment facilities so people can get the help that they need. This is kind of that underbelly where people are getting kickbacks from referring people for maybe some treatment that they don't need, or sending them to a facility that's maybe not the appropriate facility, but they're going to get a 10% cut of whatever somebody is paying to that facility to be able to make that. So it is a new criminal act that can be charged as a crime for people who are making payments or soliciting payments for referring an individual for substance use treatment.
House Bill 38, fireworks restrictions. We are in fireworks season as we speak.
I hate it. I hate fireworks.
Dogs hate fireworks too. So sales, those dates have changed. They may not begin until June 24th and must end by July 25th. Discharge of fireworks can be from July 2nd through July 5th, July 22nd through July 25th, December 29th through December 31st, and 2 days prior through Chinese New Year's Eve, which, of course, that's the question of the hour. When the heck is Chinese New Year's Eve? According to Wikipedia, it is the first day of the new year falling on the new moon between January 21st and February 20th. So for 2019, it is February 4th, but it is a moving holiday, so just be aware of that and check for future years. Also, as part of this bill, they have increased the sanction or the fine for violations to $1,000 maximum, which is a good thing, trying to offset the hazard that we have fighting fires here in the state. And then it also creates a cause of action for negligently, recklessly, or intentionally causing or spreading a fire through fireworks. And specifically, when a minor causes a fire, the parents can be civilly liable and subject to that cause of action as well.
I really have become a fireworks Grinch in my old age. Last night, as they were firing off, I was thinking, I've got to wake up and go to work tomorrow. Can't somebody stop doing this? Anyways, I digress. House Bill 43 is a bill that proves that there are many different ways to get a bill passed in the Utah legislature. We have concerned citizens groups. We have lobbying groups, different people, constituencies that can do things another way that you can guarantee that we'll get a law passed as if you arrest a nurse. And that is what House Bill 43 directly is in result of. The situation that was widely publicized up at the University of Utah Hospital. Essentially what this does is it's blood testing amendments, and it has codified what was already in case law. So we're lucky that this bill doesn't do too much to us, doesn't really change the law at all, actually. But state code now says that any time we are going to take a blood draw for DUI-related purposes under the DUI laws, that you need one of three things. You need consent, you need a warrant, or you need a judicially recognized exception to the warrant requirement. And that is already what case law required. That's already what the law was. But maybe this is just a clarification to ensure that we don't have any other instance like that going forward, that we can simply just rely on state code now. Consent, warrant, judicially recognized exception to the warrant. And so just make sure that we have one of those if we're going to be doing any blood draws.
House Bill 59 deals with our correctional facilities. It specifically prohibits using unmanned aircraft to carry or drop items within a correctional facility, so drones. They cannot carry or drop items. If they do so, there's a penalty of a third-degree felony. If they are using the drone just in a manner that interferes with the operations or security of the facility, so maybe they're just having a look around, curious, at that point where it's interfering, it would be a Class B misdemeanor. However, if they deliver or drop anything, including even a note declaring their undying love, that would be a third-degree felony.
So no more love notes into the
no
jails.
No more love notes.
All right. House Bill 65, Ignition Interlock Amendments. This is a bill that's purely administrative, but we want to make officers aware of it just because you may see a little bit of a difference. In the past, it's always been that if somebody got a DUI conviction, they needed, or DLD would put an interlock restriction on their license. Now, if a person gets a DUI conviction and the evidence shows that there was no alcohol involved whatsoever, so it's strictly a drug-related DUI, courts have the ability in their notification to DLD of the conviction to make a notation that it's drugs only, and DLD no longer has to make that person an interlock-restricted driver under the code. Essentially, what this is, again, it's an administrative function. Officers don't really need to worry about it, but you may see a record that you're checking where you see somebody has a fairly recent DUI conviction and you're wondering why they aren't interlock restricted. And that could be the explanation as to why that is. Again, nothing's going to change on your end. The interlock restrictions will still show the same way they always have. However, just be aware that there may be some DUI convictions where the interlock does not apply anymore.
House Bill 77, Criminal Code Amendments, is addressing the definition of indecent liberties. Now, this is language that is found in a number of different sex offenses, including sexual abuse of a minor, unlawful sexual conduct with a 16 or 17-year-old, forcible sex abuse, sexual abuse of a child or aggravated level of that offense, custodial sexual relations involving youth or adults, and also some chapter definitions such as molestation. There's also a civil action involving sex abuse of a child that is impacted. So what this bill does is it has gone in and codified or attempted to codify some case law that addressed the definition application of that language, indecent liberties. And what it now says is a definition as follows. Number one, touching the actor's genitals, anus, buttocks, pubic area, or female breast against any part of the body of the victim. Number two, causing the victim to touch the actor's or another's genitals, pubic area, anus, buttocks, or female breast. Number three, simulating or pretending to engage in sexual intercourse with the victim, including genital-to-genital, oral-genital, anal-genital, or oral-anal intercourse, Or number four, causing the victim to simulate or pretend to engage in any of those interactions. So also note that pubic area is new language in the code. We've not had that referenced before. There will likely be some discussion as to where that begins and ends, so to speak, but that's a battle that'll be fought out in the courts. So just be aware, if you're investigating any of these sex offenses and feel that your offense falls into indecent liberties, be sure to check this definition. House Bill 86, manslaughter amendments. This statute is in response to the tragic situation where someone is suicidal. They reach out and share those feelings with someone else, and instead of getting them help or assistance, they actually aid them in dying by suicide. A most tragic situation. So it is now falling under manslaughter. In some instances, we might be able to prove it as homicide, and that this certainly does not remove that opportunity for us to do so if we can prove it. However, because of the circumstances, sometimes that is also difficult to do. So it's now part of the manslaughter statute. Specifically, there is a sanction where an individual helps a suicidal person die by suicide rather than accessing support and help. And this is triggered when a person intentionally and with knowledge that another individual intends to commit suicide or attempt to commit suicide, if they aid that individual to commit suicide. So without any doubt, we want people seeking help and intervention for individuals at that point of their life, feeling suicidal and not aiding them in the process.
House Bill 98 is driving under the influence revisions, which is a bit of a misnomer because it doesn't actually do anything to our DUI law. However, it is a follow-up bill to our House Bill 155 last year that reduced the per se BAC from a 0.08 to a 0.05. That bill, as you recall from last year's legislative update, did multiple things. However, it wasn't just a reduction of the per se BAC. One of those things was a new class of alcohol-restricted drivers, novice licensed drivers. That actually has been taken out of the code now. And the implementation date on that was the same as the 05, so December 30th, 2018. So that change actually had never gone into effect and is now being taken out of the code. So it's something you don't have to worry about in regards to that. I do want to mention, however, because almost as important, and in some cases more important, I guess, as what bills pass in a legislative session or what bills do not pass in a legislative session. And this year there were, you know, three or four bills that were all targeting that 05 implementation, either to repeal it, to delay it, to change it, to do something. And all of those bills failed. So what that means is December 30th, 2018, Utah becomes the first state in the country to have a per se 0.05 standard for DUI. I'm not going to beat a dead horse with this. As we've traveled around the state and done this legislative update, we've talked very extensively about this situation. I'm going to be a little bit more brief here today. I'm just simply going to say, do not change how you do DUI work with this change. It doesn't necessitate you changing anything. And really, if you change how you do it, you're going to screw things up for us. So don't change how you're doing your work. Do your investigation the exact same way on December 31st as you did on December 29th. It's just one of those things where I talk to officers and they think, you know, do I need less to make an arrest? No, you do not. You need the same level of probable cause for impairment that you did before. We're simply talking what the per se level is. And you never know that until you go and get an evidentiary test anyways. You won't know that when you make an arrest. And so to make the arrest, you still need probable cause that somebody's impaired or unsafe to operate a vehicle the exact same way as you did before. So please do not change how you're doing things. There will be training that's available. Highway Patrol is rolling out a refresher course for all of their troopers, which will become available for other agencies as requested. So if your agency's interested, you can reach out to Highway Patrol. You can reach out to me. You can reach out to anybody if you have training or questions, training needs or questions on this. But just keep doing it the way that you've always done it. I will say, though, we need to enforce this law. I'm getting the vibe that some people say, oh, well, maybe if they're close, I may not arrest. If they're over an 05, they're per se against the law and they need to be arrested. So enforce the law, just don't change how you're doing it.
So we're really just looking for a culture shift, right?
Absolutely.
And that's a good thing. We want people absolutely to go out and have a good time, but then to think about their safety and ability to drive.
Absolutely. That's all it is. And the legislature made very clear that they're not looking for a whole new slew of arrests. We're not looking for our DUI arrests to go up. They actually would love for our DUI arrests to go down because of, like Marlee said, that culture shift and people realizing that it's just not safe to drink and drive. And hopefully that's the message that will be sent. And over the years, we'll see a reduction in our DUIs, just like we did when we went from a 1.0 to an 0.8. So House Bill 102, Use of Force Amendments, this is kind of a funny bill. Really, Utah has a provision right now. Well, used to have a provision. I guess it still is a provision. If somebody was committing a felony or attempting to commit a felony or fleeing from the commission of that felony, that they could not avail themselves of the self-defense defense in Utah State Code. That was problematic for a legislator who ran this bill. And really the idea was that polygamists in Utah are always committing a felony, technically speaking. And so they could never defend themselves or others under the code if they are polygamist. So the idea was to eliminate this code entirely. That becomes problematic in a lot of our cases. This is an important provision for a lot of our cases, particularly with trafficking, gang-related cases, things like that. And so they came to a compromise, and essentially it's a little bit of a tricky worded compromise, but basically says that if the felony you're committing is not related to the self-defense, then you can still use it. But really what we need to understand for purposes of this bill is polygamists in Utah can now defend themselves and others under the code.
House Bill 132, Juvenile Justice Modifications. As you may recall, last year we had a huge reform involving the juvenile justice system rollout. As a result of that, there were a lot of issues that arose that needed to be corrected. And the representative on this bill has done a great job in going out and listening to and finding out what we need to do to improve it and to fill those gaps. So just a couple to be aware of in general. The previous reform bill did cause some problems as far as the empowerment of school resource officers to do their job. This bill addresses that and now clearly allows school resource officers to investigate crime, conduct probable cause searches, consult with administrators about enrolled minors, lawfully transport minors, take temporary custody of minors, and protect the safety of students and the school community. This bill also talks about using alternative intervention in courts involving minors in a lot of different offenses, including truancy. It specifies that we cannot take a truant student to secure detention for that underlying offense of truancy. I don't believe that was occurring, but it does make it clear that that should not occur. And this is a bill that went into effect March 16th. So there was some urgency in getting it in place and fixing some of the problems. It is also a very long bill. So if you work with the juvenile system or are a school resource officer, this is a bill that you do need to pull up, House Bill 132, and read through it. There's a lot more in it that we're not going to highlight during this broadcast, but it's one that you need to take a look at.
House Bill 145, Pedestrian Safety Amendments, does two things. In Utah code, we've differentiated in the past between school crossings and crosswalks. And for something to be an active school crossing, it had many of the same qualifiers that a speeding in a school zone had, where you needed signage and lights flashing and notification, or it was not an active school crossing. We had at least one jurisdiction where this was problematic as their courts were not ruling those as just normal crosswalks. So if the lights weren't flashing or whatever and people were in the crosswalk, the judge was not considering those as just a crosswalk. They were just saying it was just a regular road. So essentially, this change goes in and removes all of those qualifiers and says a crosswalk is a crosswalk. And whether it's a school crossing or it's a crosswalk, if there's a pedestrian in it, then the driver's duty is to stop and to yield to that pedestrian. And so we no longer have the qualifiers for those school crossing zones, essentially. They just are just like now crosswalks. And if there's a pedestrian there, we have to stop. The other thing is it adds certain roadways, types of roadways, to our panhandling statute. And people probably won't like me saying that out loud, calling it a panhandling statute, but that's exactly what it is. So we'll call a spade a spade. But there is already quite a long list of roadways where that type of behavior is not allowed. And this adds a couple of those. So if you're having problems in your jurisdiction and you want to do some enforcement, go ahead and take a look at this. Take a close look at the whole list including the two new types of roadways that were added this year to see if they apply to your situation.
But this really is a public safety bill. You know, panhandling is where we see it occurring most frequently, but it's for anyone approaching a vehicle in these roadways because that's not safe either for the pedestrian or the distraction to the drivers. So
yeah, we definitely don't want people asking for money down I-15, right?
Yes. No. Okay. House Bill 152. This is a Good Samaritan law amendment. This is addressing the situation where we see children being left in vehicles. What it provides is immunity for damages in a civil action if a person uses reasonable force to enter a locked vehicle to remove a confined child. There are some limitations to it. The following criteria must be met in order for this immunity to attach. The first is that the person, the rescuer, has to have a good faith belief that the confined child is in imminent danger or suffering physical injury or death. The second is that they have to determine that the motor vehicle is actually locked. So we can't have them causing any damage to a vehicle where they could just have opened a door. The third is that before entering the vehicle, the person must notify first responders, call 911, notifying them of the confined child. And that's for a couple reasons. Obviously, we would like to have law enforcement en route to deal with the investigation part of this and possible criminal charges. But we absolutely would like medical to be en route because we want to bring aid to the child as quickly as possible. The fourth one is that the person does not use more force than is necessary. In other words, if they can access a vehicle through breaking one window, they don't have the ability to go around and break all the windows and kick in a couple of fenders, no matter how tempted they may be out of frustration and disgust for what's happening with this child. They cannot do that. And then the final one is that the person must remain with the child until the first responders arrive. Again, this is for valuable information, not just for criminal investigation, but for medical attention. We need to know the condition of the child, how long the child was in the vehicle. The child may be in much better condition by the time responders get there, and that's absolutely, you know, great, good case scenario. However, we need to create our information base as far as the underlying situation that the person responded to. So something to be aware of, especially as we're moving into and in this hot part of the summer, not to forget the little people. And this does apply to anyone under the age of 18, but they have to not have the ability to remove themselves from the situation. So an able-bodied 16-year-old would not be able to be rescued, would not have the need to be rescued. And for the most part, we're going to see this with our very young children and toddlers in car seats.
House Bill 161 and 162, they dovetail together very nicely to cause a whole lot of confusion for police officers. And I don't think that that was entirely on purpose, because while they are back-to-back bills, they were by different representatives, and I just don't think they could plan that type of thing. But we'll talk about these separately but kind of together just because they do dovetail nicely into each other. House Bill 161, auto registration requirements. I call this the Pirate Code Bill. That's what I like to call it, and you'll see why here in a second. Essentially, Utah code has always required that if you buy a vehicle, you get the registration, you have to keep it with you and carry it with you in the vehicle, and you would have to sign it as the owner on the registration and display it for police officers if you demanded a request on the side of the road. Now this bill actually says that, and I'm not making this up when I say that, for the convenience of the law enforcement officer, it is encouraged that you carry your registration with you and display it for the law enforcement officer if they demand on the side of the road. And so all of you have seen it, and many of you won't admit it, but you've all seen Pirates of the Caribbean. And you're all familiar with the moment where they talk about the pirate code, right? You've got to stick to the code. The code is important. And at the end of the first Pirates, when Elizabeth to Barbossa cries parley, and he doesn't grant it, and she says, well, what about the code? And he says, well, those are more guidelines than rules, right? Well, House Bill 161 is evidence that Utah code is a little bit like the pirate code in that we have more guidelines than rules, at least when it comes to auto registration now. There is no opportunity for an officer to cite somebody anymore for not carrying registration. It is no longer required for somebody to carry their registration and display it for you. So, but out of your convenience, we're strongly encouraged to do so. So again, like the pirate code. House Bill 162, license plate transfer amendments. this is another bill that, as when we look in, that people won't be carrying registration or won't need to be carrying registration anymore, that causes a little bit of confusion. There's never been a provision in Utah law until now that allows somebody to transfer a license plate with the sale of a vehicle. That is now the case. It used to be that you'd have to remove those plates and destroy them or turn them in and notify DMV and all those things. That's not the case anymore. A person can make the sale of a license plate a part of the sale of a vehicle now, or a transfer of the license plate a part of the sale of the vehicle. They have to do that officially. But the thing that becomes problematic here is none of the other laws were changed. A person still has the duty to go and register that vehicle in their name immediately. They don't get any grace period. It has to be registered in their name. They have to go to the DMV and apply for a transfer of that plate to be in their name. If they don't do that, they're still guilty of driving with plates to a previous owner. They're still guilty of not having a validly registered vehicle on the roadways. And so when you look at these bills, especially together, somebody won't have their registration. They might have a plate to a previous vehicle on. It could cause a lot of confusion for an officer about who the true owner of a vehicle actually is. And so just be aware of that. Be aware that that's out there. There is a provision in here. We do have specialty plates, right, for the Marine Corps or fire fighters, different things like that. The person receiving the plate still has to qualify for that. That's not a criminal provision, so nothing you need to worry about. But DMV will be checking to make sure that the person still qualifies for that specialty plate. But just be aware of that. The effective date on House Bill 162 is January 1st, 2019. So starting January 1st, coming up here in the end of the year, people will be able to transfer their license plates as part of a sale of a vehicle. Oh boy, we get to talk about marijuana now. This has become my favorite topic as of late, so this is great. There was actually three bills that passed, and I will go through these very quickly. I will try not to spend too much time on this because there's just a lot here. And not a ton of it applies to law enforcement. But there were three bills that passed this legislative session that are specifically around medical cannabis. House Bill 195 is what I like to call the right to try before you die bill. And essentially what this is if you have a medical diagnosis from your doctor that is terminal and you've been given 6 months or less to live, you can now get a recommendation from your doctor in Utah to use cannabis-based products to treat the symptoms. Essentially, what that means is this isn't just a wholesale go out and smoke weed from your corner drug dealer anytime you want. There are some restrictions on this, all right? And I'll talk a little bit about those restrictions. Physicians can only recommend to 25 patients at a time. So if you're patient number 26, sorry, right? I guess we don't care about you. And so they have to keep, doctors have to keep very meticulous logs and things to ensure that they're not recommending to more than 25 patients at a time. They also can only have a 1 month supply at a time. And so you're going to have to go and refill your recommendation. Notice how I'm not calling it a prescription. It is not a prescription. It is a medical recommendation to utilize these drugs. Also, the drug needs to be in medical dosage form. And there's a lot of things in the code that talk about what medical dosage form is. That's actually defined. It's a defined term. I will tell you what it's not. Smoking. Smoking is not a medical dosage form and never will be. A doctor worth the weight of his diploma or her diploma will never tell you that it's going to be good for you to go and smoke something. So that's just not ever going to be medical dosage form. So if somebody, even if they are in the last 6 months of their life, they have medical recommendation and they're smoking, they can't avail themselves of this here. So, and there's more to this, but again, that's kind of the stuff that applies to law enforcement. House Bill 197, the Cannabis Cultivation Amendments. This is the bill that basically gives the state the authority to cultivate and to dispense of the medical marijuana. And so, again, not a lot to do with law enforcement, but just realize that that is out there. Senate Bill 130 is the other bill that has to do with medical marijuana. And the vast majority of it has to do with the Department of Agriculture and their duties of going and getting a handshake deal from the federal government that they're not going to come in and prosecute all our state employees for growing and distributing marijuana, which is against federal law. But then they have to come up with the licensing and all sorts of other things quite frankly, I don't know and won't ever need to know about. However, there is one line in Senate Bill 130 that does impact us in the criminal justice world greatly, and it is an amendment to our Code 416A517, or what we affectionately call our metabolite law. In that law, there's always been three affirmative defenses. So if you're driving with a measurable controlled substance and you are able to avail yourself of one of these three things, that you lawfully ingested the controlled substance, that it was prescribed by a practitioner for use by the driver, or if it was unknowingly, like you didn't know you took it, somebody spiked your drink or something like that, you could avail yourself of this. Now remember, 517 doesn't have anything to do with impairment. It is only just that presence of a controlled substance or the metabolite of a controlled substance. And so we're not talking about impairment. If we're charging under the DUI law, those affirmative offenses do not apply. What this bill did is on that second affirmative defense, prescribed by a practitioner, it now says prescribed by a practitioner or recommended by a doctor for use by the driver, essentially. And so that broadens that scope because marijuana is not available for prescription. And I made that differentiation earlier, and that differentiation matters. When our statute says it has to be a prescription, it has to be a prescription. And the legislature has now broadened that defense when it comes to marijuana because now we can get medical recommendations in Utah and a myriad of other states. There's, you know, well over a dozen states that give medical recommendations for marijuana now. So if a person, if you make an arrest for driving with a measurable controlled substance or a metabolite for marijuana and the person shows up to court with a medical recommendation after the implementation of this law, we will lose 100% of those cases. And that change to 517 goes into effect July 1st, 2019. So we're a little over a year, or about a year away from that going into effect. And so just be aware of that. So the answer to that is if you make a stop and you believe that marijuana is involved, do the DUI investigation first. And if you can't arrest for impairment under DUI, you can always fall back to metabolite. But realize that if they show up with a medical use card, we're going to lose the case. But if you give us a DUI where you can show that they're actually impaired, then it won't matter if they've got the medical use card. So just be aware that there's a little bit of a change there that makes a big difference. We're in a whole new world of marijuana laws now, and we'll see how all this goes going forward.
House Bill 222, Peace Officer Amendments. This is addressing the broad definition of a peace officer, which includes correctional officers, special function officers, federal officers, and law enforcement officers. However, peace officers cannot give the command to stop if a suspect is in a motor vehicle. That command must come from a law enforcement officer in order for there to be criminal sanction for noncompliance. So that's what this bill is addressing. It specifically states that if a suspect is in a motor vehicle, the command to stop must come from a law enforcement officer, Category 1 officer. The failure to respond to the command of a peace officer, which is another statute, that is fine to come from any peace officer as defined, any officer as defined in the peace officer definition. But if a suspect is in a motor vehicle, then that command must come from a law enforcement officer.
House Bill 226, Citation Authority Amendments. This is a bill that's a follow-up again to another bill from 2017. In 2017, we had a law passed that basically said that only certified law enforcement officers could issue criminal or misdemeanor citations. That bill had a pushed back implementation date, though, however, so that's probably why nobody realized or felt the change in that, because it actually hadn't gone into effect. This was problematic for a lot of our cities, because a large portion of misdemeanor citations within animal control, code enforcement, fire, different things like that were actually being issued by non-law enforcement certified law enforcement officers. So this bill actually kind of walks that back a little bit. So fire officers and animal control officers may still issue citations in the furtherance of public safety in their roles, in their respective roles. So that helps with that. However, if your city or county still does criminal code, your code enforcement officers are not going to be able to issue a misdemeanor citation for like excess junk vehicles or weeds or any of those things when it comes to code enforcement. That's still going to have to be done by a law enforcement officer. Or you can screen it directly to your prosecutor for criminal charges if you want. However, that citation just will not be able to be issued there. But it does restore the ability for animal control and fire, which was the biggest concern pretty much around the state from everything that we had heard.
House Bill 269 is addressing identity theft paraphernalia provisions. Of course, identity theft is a moving target. It's something that we're continually trying to address through our criminal process. Specifically, this bill is dealing with the elements of financial transaction card offenses and unlawful possession of another's identifying documents. So within those two categories of identity theft crimes, there is verbiage specifically, quote, multiple documents. So what this bill does is it addresses and defines what multiple documents means. They've determined that documents or someone possessing a document more than two but less than 100 is a third-degree felony. However, if it is 100 or more, it would be a second-degree felony. So just take a look at that definition as it relates to identity theft, the financial transaction card offenses, and unlawful possession of another's identifying documents. And if you have a suspect with multiple documents, you'll just need to determine if it's more than two but less than 100 or 100 or more, and that'll bring you to the correct severity of charge, whether it's a third-degree felony or a second-degree felony.
House Bill 295 is a driving under the influence modification. This is strictly a wrong-way DUI bill, all right? And it's not just wrong-way down Main Street or down 1300 East or whatever it is. This is wrong-way on either a freeway or a controlled access highway. If somebody is going the wrong direction on one of those two roadways, a freeway or a controlled access highway, and they're found to be DUI, the baseline for that charge is now a Class A misdemeanor. There's no provision for a Class B misdemeanor under that. So just be aware of that. That's going to impact our troopers mostly, but we do have city agencies and county agencies that will be involved in these as well. So just be aware that DUI, and if they're a wrong way on a freeway or a controlled access highway, then that offense is baseline of a Class A misdemeanor. This is simply the legislature acknowledging that these drivers are putting themselves, other drivers, and particularly our officers in huge danger. And so we're not going to treat them the same as a run-of-the-mill DUI, which are dangerous anyways. But these ones are really, really dangerous. And the techniques that our officers have to use in many of these cases to stop these drivers are very dangerous. They put themselves in grave peril. And the legislature recognizes that and now is saying that we're going to treat these differently because they are different. So Class A misdemeanor, that is a change that took place this year.
House Bill 321 deals with duties following an arrest. There was a case that came out of the higher court that discussed how Utah law imposed the obligations of the arresting officer and the jail personnel, basically that they shared these responsibilities. And so this bill goes in and clarifies that. And what it says is that if a jail accepts custody of a person arrested, now this is an arrest without a warrant, then all the duties under 77-7-23 of that section imposed on the arresting officer, such as arranging their appearance for arraignment or the setting of bail, those kinds of responsibilities are transferred to the jail and the jail's personnel. I don't know that perhaps maybe in our most rural areas that this was a factor where someone was making an arrest and then it was their responsibility to follow up and make sure someone was getting to court and being arraigned. But this statute clarifies that is not the case, that it does not need to be the case, that an arresting officer, typically those duties will then transfer to the jail once they've been booked in. House Bill 439, this is kind of a hide-and-seek bill. It's dealing with the penalties for sexual abuse. There are a number of sex offenses where if a person, the perpetrator, is a person in a position of trust, such as a school employee, volunteer, or parent, that it would have an enhancement to a third-degree felony. Now, previously, what we've seen in the statute is the statute itself defining the offense, then a penalty, and then another penalty addressing the person in a position of trust enhancement. This bill goes in and removes all those secondary penalty provisions and combines them into one new statute. So there's a new statute enacted that deals with individuals in a position of trust and allows it to be enhanced one degree. That new statute is 76-3-203.13. So if you're looking at a sex offense and it's one that you believe there is a position or person in a position of trust enhancement available, just look. It is still there. It's just been combined into one statute instead of spread out for each relevant offense. And so again, that new statute is 76-3-203.13.
Senate Bill 20 and Senate Bill 180 I'm going to talk about together here. They're semi-related. Senate Bill 20 does a few things. First and foremost, for our wildlife officers, it repeals Section 232027, which is essentially altering your tag or changing your tag to hunt. And on surface, that seems like a big deal in that that's crazy that we did that. However, what you need to understand is under 766501, it is already a felony for somebody to alter a writing for the purpose of defrauding. And so we can actually charge, it's the same conduct of if you change your tag, which was a misdemeanor under the wildlife code, or if I change my tag under the criminal code, it's actually a felony under the criminal code, and it applies to any writing, not just a tag. So we can still prosecute that. We can actually prosecute it at a higher level, a felony rather than a misdemeanor, but realize that that wildlife code has been repealed. It also went through the bill or through the Utah code, and there are many places in it where it talks about that a violation of this section is a misdemeanor, and it doesn't articulate what level of misdemeanor it is. Well, they think they've gone through and they've caught all those and changed all those to Class B misdemeanors. So those have all been listed as Class Bs. The last thing that Senate Bill 20 does is it says that if you are a city or a code and you have criminal provisions in your city or code, and similarly, you just call them misdemeanors. You don't call them Class B misdemeanors, or you don't call them Class C misdemeanors. You just call them misdemeanors. You have until July 1st, 2019 to change those to articulate, just like the state code did, what level of misdemeanor it is. Otherwise, that will default to an infraction under state law. So I know police officers aren't the ones in charge of writing city or county codes, but if you know of any of those in your city or county codes, you may want to let your attorneys know that they need to work with the council to change those things and articulate. You can still have them as misdemeanors. They just have to be articulated at what level of misdemeanor they are. Senate Bill 180 is a furtherance of kind of the habit that we've had every year of going through and reviewing code sections and determining if they're appropriately charged as misdemeanors or if they should be infractions. And the last few years, we've had quite long lists of those. This year, we only had a few that were done, the most serious of which was holding a coyote or a raccoon in captivity without a license. So if you have anybody that you're concerned about that has pet coyotes and doesn't have a license for that anymore, you can no longer arrest them and take them to jail. You can only issue them a citation for an infraction. Our colleague Will Carlson with the DA's office, he made the comment that he thought that the penalty for holding a raccoon was actually holding the raccoon. However, it's not. The penalty for that is actually an infraction. So just be aware of that.
Senate Bill 27, this is a huge bill addressing domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking offenses. So as law enforcement, anyone dealing with these types of cases, it really is a must that you pull up Senate Bill 27 and read through it. I'm not going to cover everything in it. I'm going to highlight some of the most, probably most frequently seen issues, but there is a lot in here, and it absolutely is one that you need to pull up and read yourself. So starting out with law enforcement duties and notices, we're all aware and we have for a number of years been following through on the duties and notices that are mandated in domestic violence cases. Those duties and notices are now exactly duplicated and applied to stalking charges and dating violence charges. So just be aware of that. All the duties and notices previously impacting domestic violence cases are now applicable to both stalking and dating violence. The next part is potential domestic violence-related offenses. As you're aware, there is a statute that lists a large number of offenses that can be charged as domestic violence offenses. However, that list is not exclusive. There are other crimes that may occur that fit under the introductory language of that statute that involves violence, use of violence. So, for example, in the past, brandishing a weapon during a fight could be charged as a domestic violence offense, even though it was not on the list. This bill now adds that offense to the list, and as well as several others. So you need to pull up that bill and take a look at the new charges. But just be aware that it's not just those charges on the list, that it's any charge involving violence, that can be charged and should be charged as a domestic violence offense so that the higher level of accountability and intervention can come into play. Also be aware that the recently passed revenge porn in the last couple years, the statute involving that is not on the list. We're working trying to get that added, hopefully in the next legislative session, because it also does not involve violence. But if that question arises as you're looking at that, of course, cohabitants are going to be the ones most frequently impacted by that kind of criminal conduct. And presently, it cannot be charged as domestic violence, but we are aware of that and working on that. The definition of married and living together and the definition of separated has now been amended in this statute or in this bill. It now has just brought it into current gender-neutral language. It no longer specifies man and woman. There's also a provision regarding the return of any confiscated weapons. So previously, you might be out on a call involving domestic violence and have taken weapons as a matter of evidence and or safe keep. Evidentiary-based seizures of weapons, those weapons go nowhere until your prosecutor gives the okay for those to be returned or disposed of. However, other weapons confiscated, perhaps for safe keep, or because the owner of them is now going to jail, those weapons, if a stalking injunction or a protective order is not issued, those weapons can be returned. Now, this does not undermine your agency's policies as far as when and what requirements need to be in place for a weapon to be returned. In other words, they still have to pass Brady. They still have to show that they're the registered owner, that they're the lawful owner. Whatever your agency policies are, this would not undermine any of that. It's just indicating that above and beyond that, they can be and should be returned if those factors are met. The definition of cohabitant, it has also been amended in a couple different ways. First of all, previously, the verbiage of being related by blood or marriage to the other party did not have limitations. So essentially, my husband's brother's aunt's grandma's son's nephew could commit offense against me. And because we're related by marriage, that would be domestic violence. That is never, of course, the intent of the statute. This just clarifies it and allows it only to be to the second degree in consanguinity. So basically two steps. It's domestic violence if it's the person's parent, grandparent, sibling, or any other person related by consanguinity or affinity to the second degree. And then also, as part of the cohabitant definition, there is a new category, and it's going to broaden our ability to charge domestic violence offenses significantly, which may cause some frustration or consternation. No doubt this is in response to the increased epidemic that we have of domestic violence assaults and homicides. Sadly, in the old days, we certainly saw one perpetrator committing a homicide against a victim and then committing suicide. But now they seem to be taking out whole families in the process as well. And so this statute basically is trying to address this and err on the side of safety, again, to get that intervention and that accountability in place, trying to address this concern. So the new category now includes any person who is or was in a consensual sexual relationship with the other party. So just be aware of that. This will no doubt include some dating relationships or other relationships where they may not live together, they may not fit any of the other category of a cohabitant, but because they are in a consensual sexual relationship and when conduct's occurring that is otherwise domestic violence related, it can be charged and should be charged as domestic violence. Protective orders. Provisions that you see on protective orders are also changing. First of all, the harassment prohibition has been moved from the contact provision to the threats of abuse provision. So if you're familiar with that and looking for it, it has not gone away. It has just moved. In addition, the designated family or household member language previously was just in the no abuse provision, but that now has also been added to the contact provision and the stay away provisions. So be looking at those provisions specifically. Now, this is not retroactive. So there are a number of old orders that are out there. They are still valid. They are still enforceable, and they will say differently. So no doubt you are reading these provisions before making charging decisions or arrest decisions, but just be sure to do that because now there is definitely a variety of coverage and different locations of these provisions. So read the orders that you have. Protective orders are also now not going to interfere in a parent's right to be at a school of a child, of their child, not other children, but of their child. But it will impose some time, place, and manner restrictions. So instead of someone being told that they can't be at a school, they may be allowed to be there, but they'll be told what their behavior is expected to be while they're at a school event or activity. So just be aware of that. And again, it's not retroactive. So we will have some folks that are prohibited from being at a school and others that are just told how to behave while they're at the school. That is just a few of the many changes and amendments involving domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking offenses. Be sure to pull up Senate Bill 27 and read through that. I just can't stress enough how important that is.
Senate Bill 57 is dealing with our police canines, police service animals. And now, under the law, if you injure a police canine, intentionally or knowingly injure a police canine, it is a third-degree felony. If you knowingly or intentionally kill a police canine, it is a second-degree felony. So some enhancements there where we don't have to worry about animal cruelty. We don't have to go under the animal cruelty provisions or anything like that. These are simply just dealing with our police canines. The legislature is recognizing them as valuable police partners and enforcement officers. And now they have some enhancements if somebody injures or kills those animals.
Senate Bill 59 deals with theft enhancements. Last year, they changed the ability to enhance on theft offenses. However, the previous provision was not removed from the statute. So this is simply a cleanup bill. I'm not going to go into what the previous statute said because it's not relevant at this point. This went into effect May 8th. So this is what you need to know. In order to enhance on a theft offense, there have to be two priors. One must be a Class A misdemeanor, and that has to be a theft-related, fraud-related offense, as the statute outlines. Those two priors have to occur within 10 years, and the value of the theft has to be over $500. And if all of those criteria are met, then that would be a third-degree felony.
Senate Bill 66 has to do with vehicle operator duties of care. This bill is just kind of a continuation of what we've seen over the last few years when it comes to chase policies and the legislature's view on those and the need for consistency. So this bill actually does five things, and I'll tell you what those five things are, and then we'll talk about its impact. Basically, this says that any agency that has emergency vehicle operators that are involved or could be involved in pursuits, which is all police agencies, need to have a policy. All right, you must have a policy on when you can pursue, when you can't pursue, when they have to be terminated, how they have to be terminated, all those things. The second thing is that policy must conform to the minimum standards set forth in the Department of Public Safety's policy. That doesn't mean you have to mirror their policy. It just means that the minimum standards have to be there. Your policy can be more strict if you want it to be, but that is the minimum standard. The third thing is that if there is a pursuit that results in an injury or property damage, the head of the law enforcement agency, so the chief, the sheriff, whoever the head of your law enforcement agency is, has to review that incident, all right, and make a determination if that officer was outside of policy or in violation of policy as in that pursuit. The fourth thing is if the determination is made that the officer was outside of policy, the violation has to be documented and appropriate remedial actions against that officer or corrective actions against that officer need to be taken. And those corrective actions have to be documented as well. So even if your corrective action for a very, very minor policy violation is a verbal warning, don't do that again, that has to be documented under this law. And the fifth thing is all of those documents are now subject to grandma, whatever the grandma rules are. And I'm not a grandma expert, and nor will I ever become one. So I can't tell you necessarily what that means. But I will say that whatever the current grandma rules are for those documents will apply to these as well. The big take home for this is that as as an officer, you're not being told not to pursue. That's kind of part of your job, and we need to have that to be able to be part of your job. What this is saying is know your policies and follow them. And I know that these policies can be extensive. I know that they can be down to minute details in the minutia, but you need to understand that a violation of these can be very bad for you. A violation of these policies can be bad for you, both for your employment and potentially even for your liability. So just know what your department policies are and make sure you are following them, and you'll be fine on that.
Senate Bill 88 seeks to provide additional protection to vulnerable adults. So a vulnerable adult is defined as someone who has mental or physical impairment, which affects their day-to-day abilities, and individuals over the age of 65. What this bill does is, if a financial manager believes that a person has or has attempted to financially exploit a vulnerable adult, the financial manager must immediately notify the Division and Adult Protective Services. They can notify a person allowed to receive, such as a conservator or a guardian, so long as that person is not a suspect in the exploitation. What this means is we may see more of these being reported, as we should. This bill also provides that Adult Protective Services and law enforcement must be provided access to any records that are relevant to the suspected financial exploitation. Perhaps there's an anticipation that if it's a financial manager that's part of a business or an agency that looks out for this population, that they may require subpoenas or create other obstacles to releasing that information. Where they are not the suspects, this bill mandates that they do have to provide that to law enforcement and to Adult Protective Services so that they can quickly address the issue and provide intervention as needed.
Senate Bill 90 is hit and run penalties. This bill adds a new provision to our hit and run penalties. So currently, and we're talking just a regular hit and run, not one where there's injuries or deaths or other things involved, where there's already aggravators and enhancements in the code, but just a normal property damage hit and run. Right now, if the law says that a person has reason to believe that they were in an accident and they don't follow the duties underneath the code, they leave, that they're guilty of a Class C misdemeanor. And reason to believe is defined in the code. We now have a new definition of knowledge, or if they do this with knowledge that they were involved in an accident and they don't follow the duties under the code, it's now a Class B misdemeanor. So you may change a little bit of how you ask questions when it comes to a hit and run investigation. Obviously, if the front end smashed in on a vehicle, we know that they know that they were in an accident, right? We're usually talking about just little fender benders or back into a car, into a parking lot and make a scratch and leave. So the damage isn't normally in these cases very high. But realize that if we can show they had knowledge, we can charge a Class B. So you may need to ask a few more questions or a few different questions to get us beyond reason to believe, because knowledge is going to be a little bit higher of a burden than that reason to believe. Senate Bill 97 is driving without insurance amendments. Essentially, one of the crimes that was reduced to an infraction in the past was no evidence of security. As it stands right now, that bill is still an infraction, or that law is still an infraction for a first offense. However, if there's any subsequent offense in the next 3 years, we can charge that as a Class C misdemeanor. So if you're going to write a ticket for no evidence of security, take a close look at their history and see if they have another one of those in the last 3 years. And if they do, you can write that citation as a Class C. We as prosecutors can charge that as a Class C. Senate Bill 154, prohibition of law enforcement quotas. That word, the Q word, is a bad word in a lot of areas. We don't like quotas as a society, and the legislature really doesn't like quotas unless they're the ones that are giving them, and then they tend to be fine with them. In the law enforcement world, that Q word is a bad word. We don't like to use that word. It doesn't gain us any favors with the public. It doesn't do any of that. Well, this bill actually prohibits any type of quota system for citations or arrests in any law enforcement agency. So what you have is you have a situation now where an agency cannot set quotas for citations or arrests. That does not mean that they can't look at your performance and do things. They still can put performance standards on, because, again, we don't use the Q word. They're performance standards, not quotas. They can still put a performance standard on something like community contacts. So if I'm sending you out on a certain kind of shift, I expect you to make X amount of community contacts during that shift. That's still fine. However, you can't be told you have to write this many citations during your shift or make this many arrests during your shift. So just be aware of the change there in the state code in regards to that. Senate Bill 177 is the last bill I will talk about here today. Marlise has a couple more, but it is my favorite. The last, the best for all the game, I guess, is how this one applies. This has to do with bicycles and electric-assisted bicycles. I'll tell you the first part of it that's maybe a little bit more serious and doesn't don't get quite as big of a kick out of. But there are many places where we have traffic control devices, signs that say no bikes on the sidewalks, maybe in your city codes. We see these on campuses, universities in particular. We have a lot of that. Those things are still okay, but those can only apply to people 18 years and older now. So basically what they're saying is for those 17 and younger, we're okay if they ride their bikes on the sidewalk. We'd rather have our kids on the sidewalk than in the street, I guess, is maybe the policy decision here. The other thing that this bill does, and everybody's familiar with our open container law. If you have an open container of alcohol in the passenger compartment of a vehicle, you're guilty of the open container. It's pretty straightforward. Well, this law now applies to Class 2 electric-assisted bicycles. Now, I would be willing to bet that very few, if anybody that ever listens to this recording, will know without looking up what the definition of a Class 2 electric-assisted bicycle is, and so I'm going to tell you. Under the Utah Code, a Class 2 electric-assisted bicycle is a bicycle an electric-assisted bicycle equipped with a motor or electronics that may be used exclusively to propel the bicycle and is not capable of providing assistance when the bicycle reaches speeds of 20 miles per hour. So you've all seen those bikes that have the little motors on them. You get going, it can get you going, but once it gets 20 miles an hour, the motor cuts off. You have to go straight to human power at that point. Why this bill only applies to Class 2 electric-assisted bicycles, I will never know. Because we have Class 1 electric-assisted bicycles in the code, and we have Class 3 electric-assisted bicycles in the code. But this bill only applies to Class 2 electric-assisted bicycles. I didn't understand why we would need it on an electric-assisted bicycle anyway until Marlise and I were up in Davis County, and we're giving this, and I talk about this bill, and there was a DWR officer in the back who raised her hand, and she said, "This is a duck hunting bill." And being a duck hunter myself, it was like the rooftops opened and light shone upon me, and I finally understood what this was all about.
It was a significant aha moment for you, Tyson. I will never forget.
And I guarantee if the cameras were on me, you could probably just see like my face just light up because I finally had an understanding on this one. For any of you who are duck hunters and spend any time around the marshes of the Great Salt Lake, you know that those waterfowl management areas are impounded by dikes. And that's how they keep all the water in, and that's how a lot of people will travel to get to their duck hunting spot. And it used to be in the old days you'd have to walk out those things. But it was, you know, when I was a teenager, I figured out that I could ride my bike down the dike a lot quicker than I could walk down the dike. And now with an electric-assisted bike, I can hook up the little baby travel trailers behind my bike and throw all my decoys in there, and I don't even have to break a sweat anymore. And so when she said this is a duck hunting bill, I thought, well, of course, because why wouldn't somebody have an open container of alcohol on their Class 2 electric-assisted bike as they're cruising out the dike to be shooting their 12-gauge shotgun into a crowded place at Farmington Bay? I'm sure that's not the reason why, although the senator that ran this bill is from Davis County, so who knows, maybe it is. But again, just a funny bill. If you see somebody who's on a Class 2 electric-assisted bicycle with an open container of alcohol, they are now guilty of that provision under the law.
So we now know what a Class 2 electric-assisted bicycle is, and we know when the Chinese New Year is. This is life-changing stuff.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we're down to the final three. Senate Bill 193, this is also a bill dealing with persons with disabilities, and it is addressing the consent statute for sexual activity. This bill amends the consent statute to protect them and indicates that consent is not given if the actor knew or reasonably should have known that the victim has a mental disease or defect, which renders the victim unable to do any one of four things. The first being of which that they are unable to appraise the nature of the act. There are many individuals with disabilities that cannot understand the nature of a sex act at any level, whether it's touching or full intercourse. They cannot understand the nature or appraise the nature of the act. And that being the case, they cannot give consent for that act. The second is they cannot resist the act. There are many that do not have that judgment or cognitive ability to decide if they do or do not want to be engaged in any given behavior. And if they cannot make that determination and resist the act, they cannot give consent. Number three is that they have to be able to understand the possible consequences of the victim's health or safety. So this is addressing pregnancy concerns, sexually transmitted disease concerns, and many other concerns associated with health and safety when you're involved in any kind of sexual interaction. If they cannot understand that, then they cannot give consent for the act. And the final one is if they cannot appraise the nature of the relationship between the actor and the victim. A lot of these folks are very loving, very trusting, and easily influenced. And so they could be told that someone loves them, wants to marry them, that they're their boyfriend, or even if you just are friendly towards one of them, they may feel like you're a boyfriend or a girlfriend to them just because of their loving nature. If they cannot understand the actual nature of the relationship between themselves and the actor involved in the sexual interaction, then they cannot give consent. Sadly, this is a much needed statute. There are circumstances where people knowingly and intentionally take advantage of this vulnerable population, and this is intended to provide some higher penalty and intervention to protect them. So this is a good statute. Senate Bill 214. Last year, the legislature went in and amended the penalty for patronizing a prostitute. They enhanced it to a Class A misdemeanor. The intent behind this, the premise behind this, is to try and sanction the need, those that are feeding into the sex trafficking offenses, trying to hit where the money is coming from and try to slow down the business and the need for this kind of conduct. However, the problem that occurred last year is after they amended the patronizing the prostitute, some of the language in one of the elements of patronizing is exactly word for word the same as an element in sexual solicitation. Sexual solicitation was not amended. It remained a Class B misdemeanor, which didn't make any difference to law enforcement. However, once it got to the courtroom or to the prosecutor's desk, it created a significant obstacle. We are bound by Shondell Doctrine, which is a case that came down that we cannot prosecute someone for a higher penalty if the same exact conduct is chargeable at a lower penalty. So for the last year, we've only been able to enforce this as a Class B. But again, because of that concern, they took a look at it again and they've made some changes. So here's where we're at now. And again, trying to focus on intervening and slowing down the demand in the sex trafficking industry. It now states that patronizing a prostitute and sexual solicitation are Class A misdemeanors. The third and subsequent offenses can be enhanced to third-degree felonies. In addition, they've also changed aiding and exploiting prostitution. Those are also now Class A misdemeanors, with the second and subsequent offenses being a third-degree felony. Prostitution itself as a criminal offense remains a Class B misdemeanor. With a second or subsequent offense, that can be enhanced to a Class A misdemeanor, but it was intentionally not enhanced to be a Class A at this time with the other violations, because those that engage in the prostitution very often are victims of either the person exploiting them or victims of prior abuse. And although we are seeking to have some jurisdiction and to provide intervention and aid to them to get them on a better and a safer path in life, we're not looking to increase penalty on that population. So just be aware of those changes. It's now Class A for any of the other prostitution-related offenses except for prostitution itself. And the final bill is Senate Bill 242. And this is kind of a funny bill to end off on because it is a good example of sometimes what we see coming out of the legislature as far as stereotypically expectation, where it's confusing. And this is one that is confusing. It passed just in the last few minutes of the legislature. There were not a lot of eyes on it, a lot of discussion on it. There are some concerns with it. It will be back next year to be corrected. But what this addresses is Under Utah Code 769201, this is the Electronic Communications Harassment Bill. So electronic communications harassment can no longer be charged for harassing. And you did hear me correctly, thus the confusion, and thus we will be talking about this again next year. Currently, or previously, the language was that with the intent to intimidate, abuse, threaten, harass, frighten, or disrupt the electronic communications of another person, you could charge this offense. Now it reads with the intent to intimidate, abuse, threaten, or disrupt the electronic communications of another person. So they have removed harass and they have removed frighten. There are some concerns as far as constitutional vagueness with this bill or with this statute, and that's why they've taken a look at it. They made a change a year ago as well on it and took out some other verbiage. So just be aware that for this year anyway, there is no longer harassment in the electronic communications harassment bill. So that's it for the bills for this year. Hopefully that is helpful. When we go out and do this around the state, we provide a lot of other, you know, jokes and anecdotes and make a little more informative, but we've tried to keep it very simple and straightforward for those that didn't have a chance to see that so that you could be aware of what you need to moving forward. And we just hope that you all stay safe out there.
If there's anything that we can do at UPC to serve you and your agencies, let us know. Marlise and I are very willing to answer questions, to come out and do training. If there's specific topics that you need, issues you're having in your local jurisdictions, let us know. We're willing to work with you. We want to be a resource to you and help you in any way that we can. And as she said, good luck out there. Be safe. And hopefully we'll hear from you.
And we're certainly willing to come out and accommodate shifts. Sometimes we need to come out multiple times to an agency, and we're happy to do that. We understand the manpower issues, and so we're happy to do that.
Well, thank you, Tyson Skeen and Marlise Jones with the Utah Prosecution Council for this presentation. On behalf of the Utah Prosecution Council, Statewide Association of Prosecutors, and Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training, thank you for listening in today. If you'd like more information on previous and upcoming training events, we invite you to log in to the ACATIS training portal and search under the registration tab.